Hello, everyone. You are listening to She Leads with Carly. I'm your host, Carly Malatsky, and my guest today is Zaria Smalls. Zaria received her bachelor's degree in design engineering and social change from Harvard University in 2019. And during her time at Harvard, she worked as an analyst at JP Morgan and at Ford Motor Company as a product development intern in research and advanced engineering. After graduating, she joined Twitter as an associate product manager, where she worked on the consumer privacy team and the misleading information team during the 2020 US election. Zaria is now a product manager on Spaces, working on Spaces host and creator tools. Zaria, it is so great to have you on the show. Thank you for joining. How are you doing today?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing really well. Of course. I'm in New York. It has good weather. It started up to a good day. How are you doing?
Amazing. Good. Thank you for asking. And are you working from home? Are you guys back in the office? What's the Twitter situation?
Yeah. I'm working from home today. Our office is back open, so I'll go in a couple times a week. We have a very flexible situation, hybrid, come in as you want. Nice. But today I decided to work from home.
Okay, nice. Very cool. So tell me, take me back to Harvard University, obviously not too long ago, where you graduated. But yeah. At this moment, when you were choosing internships, obviously analysts at JP Morgan, at Ford Motor Company, was product management even in the horizon then? It seems, you know, it seems different, but take me through that process of when you discovered PM and choosing internships.
Yeah. So I think my college trajectory overall was a bit different for most people and like how I found my major at Harvard and what I chose to do. When I started at Harvard, I was very sure I was going to be an electrical engineer. It seemed like the thing that like most aligned with what I wanted. But I was interning at JP Morgan, which like that disconnect was definitely there. I started interning at JP Morgan actually when I was in high school and kind of kept with it as like I was really into the time in like business and entrepreneurship and finance. And so being in JP Morgan and sales and trading felt very connected to that to like understand how the market around us works. But fundamentally, I think I didn't really it wasn't really the calling for me, like looking solely at financials. And when I was at Harvard, as I was taking like all my engineering courses, I realized I cared way less about like the exact build of things. Like I didn't care what sort of capacitors were needed or like the actual measurements behind it. I cared much more about looking at why are we building the product we're building? Does it work for the people it works for? And how do we get it to be better? And that's like all I wanted to spend my time on. And so at Harvard, we have a thing called like a special concentration. And it basically means you can kind of create your own curriculum for a major, which is what I did. And ended up studying design, engineering, and social change. And it was like heavily focused on like the design process and like what are all the steps that we do to identify a problem, get to a solution, and then like evaluate the solution, heavily focused on history of science and like how is it that technology that exists today was actually successful, making it to market. Wow. And then still focused on electrical engineering and computer science of like how do you actually build the thing you're talking about building. And so I still took EE courses and CS courses. And so from there, I was like, I need to pivot and like do something more involved in that. And I went to the National Society of Black Engineers Conference. Cool. Had a conversation with Ford and it kind of took off from there. And I think Ford was actually probably my entry point into product because what I worked in was like their research and advanced engineering department, which was all forward looking. You were working on vehicles and programs that like wouldn't hit the market for 10 plus years, just like what they were estimating and researching and seeing like how it would work. And I like loved the entire experience. And I did a lot of like human factors testing. So sitting people in cars and understanding like, is this working well? Is it dangerous? Isn't like really getting to what we were looking at. And I really liked it. And like, I wasn't sure if I was going to keep doing something like that. I was looking into their design, consultancy firms, when just like everyone was like applying for jobs and they were like, have you heard about product management? And I was like, I haven't. I sat in on some info sessions, applied to a couple of programs, and that's kind of how I got into product and spent a lot of time trying to understand exactly what a product manager does, which I think was like hard coming out of college, having not worked in product, having not been involved in like, what is, you know, social tech.
Yeah. And it's also, that's fascinating because I feel like at Ford, that's where you probably got your first taste of like customers and the user experience and gearing towards a customer. So, which is great. So now, like you said, at college, it's rare to find, you know, true product management degrees or courses or things like that. So once you discovered that APM program, what steps did you do to actually, you know, get the job and to actually to go from there? What did you do that are tangible pieces that people can take from it?
Yeah, I think I was actually pretty lucky because I created the major I did that outside of like the like hands-on courses of like building things. I took a lot of courses where fundamentally they were just focused on designing and building things. And so some of the things that stood out to me is like at Harvard at the time, there were like two big courses. One was, oh my God, I cannot remember this, but I remember my professor's name, Professor Gajos, who is amazing. He teaches a course that pretty much just like you spend your entire semester iterating on the design process and coming up with things.
Wow.
So we spent time like you would storyboard a project, you would do user research, you would like come up with a design, that you would build like a prototype of the website and you would pitch it. And you did that like at least two times that semester, which I think was really helpful and like something that just coincidentally happened right like before I was being a product manager. And then another professor at Harvard, Beth Altringer, also led a couple of like design courses. And I think she is what really like got me locked in. It was like, maybe I should move away from lecture engineering. And all of her courses were like, what is the design process? How are you identifying problems? How are you talking to customers? How are you designing? So I think those things were really helpful because it gave me, I think, what were like concrete skills that like really locked into things on product management to talk about, you know, storyboarding or user research or design thinking that like I would like to believe was like helpful for getting the job.
Yeah.
And then other things I did was like I cross-registered into MIT, and MIT has a very interesting set of curriculum that there's a ton of engineering courses about like how do you build the things. And then there's a ton of like pre-professional courses. So I went to their D-Lab, which is their design lab, and worked on a couple projects, and like you were just spending time building things and consulting with like actual companies and doing things like that I think were really helpful for just understanding how do you like actually build a product in the world and get it out the door, and what does it mean to like get it manufactured if that's what you need to do, or to like build a website and get it in front of people. And so I think those things are really helpful for me getting the role.
And it seems like and I guess the beauty of an APM program is it is built for people with minimal or no product experience. So for you, emphasizing what you learned even in the classroom and, you know, products that you built from an academic perspective, that still helped and contributed, right? That's what it seems like.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's when I talk to folks who are applying to the APM programs, eTwitter or not, I always actually emphasize that you should still include like course projects, because sometimes your work won't exactly be product management. And sometimes you find out about product management later in the game in college. And so I think coursework is actually really helpful. Did you like write a bunch of code and build this website, or did you like lead certain projects, or even your extracurriculars can apply to some of like the product management skill set that folks are looking for.
Yeah.
So I think those things are all like really helpful on that front.
And during this process, was it, you found Twitter, you knew they had an associate product management program and you were like, okay, I'm going for it. Or was it more, you know, APM program, this is what I want to do. Let's see what company has a good one. Or how did you approach this? Was it more company or product?
Good question. I knew so little about it going in. The first PM, like APM program I heard about was Google's. So Google was one of the first ones I applied to. I actually found out about the Twitter APM program from a friend who was applying for their like SWE early career program. So I probably applied to like some of the bigger ones of Google, Twitter, Microsoft. I don't think at the time I knew that Facebook had an RPM program.
Right.
So I applied to all of those. And then like in the decision-making process of like which company, for me, it really mattered about like who were the people I was working with and what sort of problems was I solving. And like, that's what really drove it. And I think the thing that stood out for me with Twitter a lot was one, the employees were like very, very cognizant that they were building a platform that inherently had so much impact on the world and can like change the way elections happen or could change the way like social movements happen just given how someone tweets out. And like they were very aware of that and trying to be super cognizant of like the things we build have worldwide impact on real people's lives, and so therefore we should think about it holistically and not just build to build, but build to try and be helpful or useful. And so I think that was important. And then the other thing that was really important that I understood about the Twitter APM program and I really appreciate was that APMs had so much autonomy and such large products for being so new to the world of product. And I think that was really amazing. Just like the projects folks have taken on and built and continue to work on, and the projects I was given to felt really important in comparison to like other places that like, that wasn't like a knock of any other place, but that they've scope them to be smaller. And I think those are also helpful because you learn a lot of product skills and you get a lot of fast iteration cycles, and there are good things about it. But I just really like the concept that you'd be given kind of like a canvas and they'd be like, go for it. And of course there's guidance, but there's a lot of room for you to like figure out what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah. Wow. So take me through, actually, first describe briefly what is an APM program, just for our listeners with general sense, and then we'll go into specifically what you did at Twitter.
Yeah, so APM program is Associate Product Manager program. And basically, it's usually for new grads or those with like less than a year of product management experience. It's a little dependent on the company. And you come in and you are a product manager. Most of them are rotational, especially coming out of like the Googles, the Facebooks, and Microsofts. Google, Facebook, Twitter, they're rotational programs. They usually last anywhere between 18 to 24 months, and you spend your time on two teams. And depending on the company, you might also have like a larger like research session that's a part of it as a way to like really understand the customers and like being a part of that process. So that's a little the high level.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It's all about and helping you build the skill set.
And so at Twitter's APM program specifically, was it rotational and you worked on different products? I know, obviously, you mentioned, or I mentioned in the intro, that you worked for the misleading information team during the 2020 US election, which I'm sure brings its own, you know, its own different nuances that are very exciting, very challenging. But take me through that. But specifically, was that the main thing that you focused on?
So I started on the consumer privacy team. It is a rotational program. Okay. So I was on two teams beforehand, before I joined the Spaces team. So I started on the consumer privacy team working on like a large scale account offboarding flow, and then later memorialization. It was my first project. It was massive, both at Twitter, across the company, and like my first encounter of like what happens when something you build hits news, for better or for worse. Wow. And then we were working on memorialization, which was an offshoot of that. So context, I was working to do a large scale deletion of accounts right around like Thanksgiving of my first year. Like, it got caught up in the news and ended up being a really big deal. It was like a very hard project for me because people were fundamentally really upset because we were talking about deleting accounts, but we had no way for you to memorialize accounts. And so we were seeing tons of articles and letters come in about like, this is the account that like, this is the last thing I might have of like a loved one who passed away. And that was felt really brutal to like build something and feel like I missed such a big area of importance and how it affects people. And coming out of there, we're like, well, we definitely have to build a memorialization product. And memorialization is just for if a user may have passed away or is otherwise unable to like get to their account for prolonged periods of time, including like medical conditions. And we were working on that and we were really close to getting something out the door. And then COVID-19 became a thing and we were like, we are building something that like no longer works the same way. Just like a world, unfortunately, dealing with grief and large scale at the same time. And it's not that memorialization wasn't relevant or even more important now. It's just that the way we were building it was no longer, what's the word I'm looking for? It wasn't even like, it hadn't considered a moment like this. And it felt almost like crass to try and put out the way we were going to put it out, which was just like, here's a product that you can do it, and not recognize like the climate we were in and the things people were going through. And so we paused that work because it just was like, it needed new eyes on it. It needed a new angle given what the world was going through. And that's actually when I moved over to the misleading information team. It was right around the same time it was going to rotate anyway. And so,
So let's hold on that memorialization feature. How far along were you guys? Was that a hard thing? You know, were you almost ready to push to production? And then it was like, look, guys, we need to put a stop. How were the team dynamics? What were the, you know, inner challenges that, that you faced with that?
I mean, we were pretty close. I would say we were no more than like maybe a month or so out from like being ready to be able to like get something out the door. And it didn't feel wrong though. It didn't feel like bad. But just like, it was such a visceral moment. And I think we all remember like when we all really started to realize like what COVID-19 was and how like pervasive it was and what was really happening, that it was 100% everybody was like, everyone who worked on the team were like amazing. And we were all super really trying to understand like how difficult it is mentally and emotionally for someone to have to go through and memorialize an account and make that a reasonable experience. And then we're like, and in this climate, it's not the right moment for us to try and unleash a product like that and get traction behind it. It just, it wasn't it. So I don't think anyone was particularly frustrated in the moment. I think everyone really understood. I think it's hard. The hard part about it is that I rotated off the team. So like that continuity to pick it back up when the moment felt right isn't really there anymore. And like, so the changing of hands and change of guards makes that more difficult.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone was upset. I think everyone like very much understood and was like, yeah.
Right. And
this is not the same.
And during this time, each rotation, you have a product manager helping you, right? It's not just you as the focus. Like there are many product managers mentoring you. How does the mentorship look?
Yeah, so I can talk about how the APM program worked when I was there. I know they've made a number of changes, all for the better. But when I was there, we kind of had like APM program leads. So there was one product manager who like ran the overall program, and we would meet with him weekly, and we would just talk about like what are things that we're learning, what are things that we need help on. He would discuss it as a group. One, I think being in APM program is also really nice, especially at Twitter. We're such a small class size that we're all incredibly close.
Cool.
And so you also leaned on the other APMs as you were going through things and learning about things. But I was on a team with two other PMs at the time, and like I would check in with them and talk with them. And I was like, here are the decisions I'm making. Is there something that seems off for you, or does this feel right? Or is there something I'm not even thinking about? Because like, it's hard to know what you don't know. And so I think all of those were really helpful on that front. And I think a big part of it.
Yeah.
And then outside of that, you also had like APM program mentors, and Twitter has its own mentorship program. Cool. So I think at any given point in time, there are a number of PMs that I could talk to about like the work that I was doing and getting help and feedback on.
Amazing. And then, so then you went on to the, you know, misleading information team, 2020 US election. Yeah. So obviously, you know, tensions are high naturally around election time. And then Twitter, you know, the beauty and also the, I don't know the word for it, but the beauty and also the, you know, pinpoint or the thorn in being a big company is that you get, you know, the great things, the publications, but also there's backlash. So take me through, take me through your experience, you know, in such a high tension feature. What were some challenges that you faced as an APM, but also, you know, generally as your team was facing this?
Yeah, I think the team that works on Misinfo is one of the like the best teams. They are really amazing. And I think one of the things that they're really good at is recognizing that pretty much everything is a high stress situation. There's never a moment that like your job is not like having huge implications on people, whether it be relevant to the 2020 election, or maybe like there's media that's circulating that's like a deep fake of like a politician or a potentially like violent event, or things are taking it out of context. And like that has such large implications if millions of people see it and they're like, this must be true. And like, it's potentially not, or like has more that people need to learn about it. I would say I probably did not have the most stressful job on it as the APM, you know, but I think it was really good and really helpful. One, to like work with a team that was like thinking, you know, like not just about a product, but they were fundamentally having to think about like the concept of misinformation and the way the world consumes, understands, and deals with it at like also somewhat of like a meta and academic level of being like, how is this like understood? How is this changing and manifesting around society?
Yeah. I want to ask now basically what you said, how, you know, some people, your users, fundamentally disagree. So on one hand, you know, you got to listen to your users, you got to, you know, really take into account, okay, is this worth building a new feature? Is this worth improving? Is it going to help Twitter as a whole? And, you know, on the other hand, they're saying like, don't do this. Whereas other users, basically, how do you balance all of that? Because you get so many different voices, so many different perspectives from it coming at every angle. So as a PM, how do you translate that?
Yeah, that is a really good question. I think it kind of depends on a lot of places and a lot of context here. One, I think it's a very collaborative effort. As a PM, you spend a lot of time working with your researchers, your designers, so many internal teams about just like what you're building, doesn't make sense and why. And tons of people will put out information for you about like, here are the things that like could be potentially difficult in building this product. And I think that's been true on Misinfo, on Spaces, on consumer privacy. And then here are the things that I think are really exciting. And like, here's the information I've gathered from all these other places that you may not touch because you like focus on a specific area that like people say there's a need for these things. And I think you use all that context to build what you can and what feels like makes the most sense. Twitter is inherently very user focused. And so much of what we do is based on like what we understand people to be like, this is helpful for me and this is what I need. And we try and stick really true to that. We believe we should build products for customer problems, customer needs, and not just because we think we should build a thing. And I think that's also been like a big crux of spaces. And so I think that's like part of it.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think it's also, you touched on like, it's this mentality as a company, knowing that, okay, we're going to release this or we're going to put this out, knowing that we may very well get backlash or something that we'll need to reiterate and reevaluate and go from there. So I think that's a, it's a good stance to be on.
And I think that's like all of product management is that, and all of what I was trying to study, which is that you're going to put something out there. It's not going to be perfect. It's almost impossible to get something perfect the first time. And first of all, when you build a product and you get it out into the world, the product evolves. It becomes different even from what you like designed. People find new use cases for. People will say, oh, this is cool. What if I did it this way or that way? And so you constantly have to reevaluate and reiterate and make improvements and build upon it. And that's like really just like the core fundamental part of product management and building products.
Yeah. And I know another aspect is this idea where as a PM, you're at the center, right? So as you said, you're talking to researchers and the marketing team, the design team and engineers. Do you, have you found it a challenge or kind of how do you approach this aspect of, I need to motivate all of these people and each one has their different, you know, the designers may want these new designs, but as an engineer, it's actually, you know, the effort is way higher than the designers think. Or, you know, as you said, reiterating features, having this mindset where we could just reevaluate, but for an engineer, again, it's a different mindset. How do you approach that? And has it helped having an engineering background from Harvard, or how do you consider it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think oftentimes everyone who has input is coming from like a very, in, like there's a point of data behind it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
There's like, whether it's like they've talked with the user, they've seen this, or they're like, this is, you know, not necessarily aligned with the way other things on the platform work. And so it's hard when you have so many inputs that like may contradict. Oftentimes I do find though that products, especially once everyone's kind of inherently agreed on the vision and the strategy and the goal of what you're trying to do, those things tend to differ a lot less. And I think, there's less of a need to like be like, oh, here are these very contentious viewpoints. That tends to happen very early on, or like when the goal and the strategy are inherently disagreed upon. And so maybe that's one of the first things I talk about, is that I think a big part of your job as like a PM should be about figuring out like what is the right strategy, the right vision, and making sure that the folks that you're working with like understand and like in agreement with that. And vision and strategy isn't something that's like made in a silo by a PM. That's oftentimes like something you figure out in conversations with other PMs and conversations with your designers, your researchers, your engineers, and like in working on spaces. Like we, when we were beginning to set up our, you know, roadmap and strategy for this year, I spent so much time with my team, my TL and my EM, my technical lead, my engineering manager, my designer. And we just like really talked about like, this is where the point we're coming from. We all inherently agree that this is the thing we're trying to chase down. What does this really mean? What does it take to get there? What is our core hypothesis about this? And does that feel like the right hypothesis? And then like, once you kind of like do those conversations and work through it as a PM, and like, you may have like a strong stance on this and like, sure. But like those things, I think really shape strategy and vision. And that's what allows for people to build good products and the right customer needs. And so a lot of that comes together and is informed by those processes.
Yeah. How often do you have those conversations with your TL, EM? When you're building the hypotheses, the strategy, the goal, is that per feature? Yeah. How often?
So what we've done is we kind of have like a core hypothesis around like Spaces hosts and the customers we're working with, that is like we're planning to try and validate as soon as possible, but it's not like feature specific. It's kind of more about like the larger strategy. And for us, that's fundamentally, you know, we talk a lot about hosts and about creator tools and about like, what do they need to be successful? So we have hypotheses around that. And that is like never feature specific, but then you do have specific features for every specific hypothesis for every feature.
Yeah.
And so we'll do that kind of like larger thing, maybe you like once a year, depending on like what sort of strategy you're putting together. You can be putting together a quarter long strategy or a year long strategy,
right,
or a 5 year long strategy. Spaces is still so nascent that like we're really not looking much further than like a year to maybe half a year out at this point in time. And so we know what we're trying to validate in this first half of the year. And then each feature we're like, oh, we think this specific feature can change this specific thing that'll ladder up into that larger hypothesis. But we're constantly rechecking in with each other of like, do we still believe this hypothesis is true? Do we think we're getting closer to proving it true or false? Or do we have more conviction? And I think those conversations should happen frequently and often to make sure we're still continually focused on the right things. And it's not necessarily changing strategy, just checking in and being like, what's right or what's wrong. We tend not to necessarily do that on like a full team level, mm-hmm. because like that is just like a lot of time to constantly be rehashing it. But yeah. like every time we get experiment results, we're talking and we're like, okay, is this feature the right one to ship based on what we found, based on the customer data, customer research? Okay. And do we think it actually did anything for that larger hypothesis? Were we right? Were we wrong? How has our confidence changed? And to be able to have that, especially on a nascent product like Spaces, where so much about this product can change and so much about it can be different on like a week to week to maybe monthly basis when we see something really cool or amazing happen, or we have really in-depth conversations. Yeah. It's important.
Yeah, no.
Maybe that's a little less true on more mature projects, but yeah.
So take me now to where you are today. You're product manager with Spaces at Twitter. And I remember when it came to be, you know, after Clubhouse came, and I don't know, maybe Twitter had this already. I'd love to know kind of the origin of it and whether you, when you joined, where you are now with it and how you guys are thinking of the future.
Yeah, for sure. So I joined Spaces in its really early beta. So like right after it got launched, maybe like the first 300, 600 people is when I like joined and was a part of that experience as we thought about like what's needed and what's rolled out. Before I joined, I know they've been working on it for a long time. It was like predating Clubhouse and wasn't necessarily responsive. It just like very coincidentally timed with the fact that Clubhouse also really got popular at the same time as like when the beta was happening there. But I know that they were trying to think about like what is a new medium and way for folks to have conversations and communicate and be a part of Twitter. And audio is 100% a part of it. A lot of folks who were on the team had previously worked on like Periscope and live video. And so they're very familiar about what it means to have like a live conversation and get a community involved in there. And that's how they ended up where they were. And so I joined during the beta. At that point, like the decision was made to like release it to some people, see how it goes, and then kind of continue on from there. And it was such a really cool experience because you could tell that it was something that ended up being really special for the folks who were a part of it. We were seeing a lot of really good traction, people having really deep, meaningful conversations. And like fundamentally, like what Spaces like come to realize is that like as Twitter's job to try and like answer and be a part of the public conversation, that so much can't happen always through text, and it can't always happen through 240 characters. And so like the work there for people to be able to communicate and have long-standing, long-form conversations and like hear voice just changes the way people interact. People are like oftentimes much nicer and more willing to hear like dissenting opinions and things like that. And we kind of just like, once we saw that it was like picking up traction and we did the beta to like a small group of folks that we thought would have a lot of influence, but also be very attuned to like, what are the ways Spaces can potentially be used in harmful ways, having been on Twitter for such a while. We'd like just put like the pedal to the metal and like it was kind of off to the races from there.
Wow. It's very exciting because like you said, like Twitter, it's known for, you know, it's limited character all through text, sharing news, sharing information, sharing opinions, whatever it may be. But here is this entire new medium and something that, you know, other platforms are definitely taking advantage of and using it as well. So how is it being at the core of the product or one of the cores as a product manager, what are the benefits and also the challenges that come with it?
I think it's potentially really cool. I think I haven't worked on a product that was like this early and also this public before, right? Like all my prior work has been in things that are really mature or like at Ford, it's like things that are really far out and like people won't see for like a decade to come. And so I think it's been really cool to like really sit with the community in a way that I don't know that like I've been able to do with other products. Every week we have like a community space where we just like talk about what's launching and what's a new feature we have, and then like also bring people up onto like the stage of Spaces and ask them like, what do you like, what do you dislike, what's going, like what's not working for you, what do you need, when did you know like this was it? And so like you can see kind of in real time how the platform evolves, and like I think most recently it was really cool for us to like see the way people describe like why Spaces were important to them in a way that we like were describing like what we're seeing from the inside within Twitter. And so I think that's really enjoyable. I think we're taking really big swings, and I've gotten to work on some features that are like really now table stakes in Spaces, like recording and co-hosting, which were really amazing to get out the door. And to know that like this is fundamentally changing the way folks are having conversations, and that there are spaces that go for like up to 24 hours of people like talking with each other all around the world is mind-boggling.
Yeah. And when you think of advancing and, you know, creating new features, listening to users, how much of a role do these outside competitors, you know, maybe they're not competing with Twitter as a whole, but they are competing with Twitter Spaces. So how do you balance that and, you know, think of it for the advancement of your own product?
Yeah, I think that is a really good question. The honest answer is within Spaces, we do notice when new things like kind of come to market, but we're not necessarily like constantly like, oh, someone just launched this, we should do that. So I remember when we launched Recording, like I think it was coincidentally like within the same 3 days Clubhouse launched Clipping, which wasn't their Recording. It was just like the like counterpart to the features of like we were obviously both thinking about Recording and Clipping. And so we're like, oh, Recording's coming out like really soon, or like we just dropped it that day. And then 3 days later, Clubhouse is like, Clipping's coming out. And so there are moments where things are like really close together. And it's funny because you're just like, we're all obviously like trying to think about like, how do you make social audio work? But like for the most part, we're not like monitoring like, oh, when things are released. It does help though to like understand like for social audio platforms that we kind of do like figure out like what makes things work everywhere. And like both in social audio and also in podcasting, like what are all the mediums that are like nearby and transitive, and like what are people like actually trying to have out of audio conversations? I think that's like the most important thing, right? So you sit in podcasts and like, why do people listen to podcasts? What makes a podcast good? Why do people listen to that? Same for social audio, it's slightly different, but why do you join? What makes it good? And those are the things that are helpful both on like from a product side and also like a content side of like understanding like what people are really into. And that's part of what we do in the community space of like, why are you here? What really works? And sometimes in the community space, we talk with people and they use both. They're honest. They're like, I'm on Clubhouse, I'm on Twitter Spaces, and here's why I'm on this platform, and here's why I'm on this one. This is what this one does for me, and this one doesn't do for me. And you have to like acknowledge your gaps. And like sometimes that happens, and there are for sure differences, and figure out like, are those differences big enough that you should like, I don't know, do something about it. Or you're like, that's just like slightly different platforms, you know?
Right, exactly. It's funny because when you mentioned how, you know, you did Clippings and then Clubhouse, I'm just imagining from the engineer perspective, like the developers are going at it and saying, okay, we need this new feature. But it is, I am curious to know also, like, have you encountered these almost stressful environments where you're like, we need to go now, like this has to be quicker than what we've done before? And how do you how do you lead that? How do you approach that?
Yeah, I would like to say I think Spaces is always going with like a sense of urgency, and I think it's because everything about this is so new, and there is sometimes like little moments appear that you're like, this is something really amazing and organic, and like if you don't capitalize on that, it's going to pass by. So there have been spaces where some really, really cool things have happened. And like, maybe part of the reasons why like we moved as quickly as we did with Recording. I think before Recording happened, there was a guy who was hosting a space on Bitcoin. And then very randomly, the president of, I think, El Salvador joined and started talking about how he wanted to use Bitcoin in like country legislation. That space like got huge because everyone's like, you're hearing like, you know, the political leader of a nation talk about a desire to move into what is fundamentally a brand new type of currency that the whole world and laws are reckoning with. And that was really cool. And like in that moment, you're like, man, I wish that was still around. Like some really crazy moment happened like that. And then it's gone because it's ephemeral. And so we're like, we got to move quickly. There's so many moments like that happening in Spaces, and how do you capture it? And so definitely that urgency there, definitely a need of like, people are putting in so much time into Spaces. We should put the time back into them so that we can get the things they need and the things they're asking for. And we try to be very open on Spaces about how we build, what we're building. If you ever join a community space, we're like super open about it, or like, oh, that's something in the works, or that's something we thought about but then decided not to do. But if you let us know why it's important, we might change that back. Like most of my DMs right now, me just talking with people who are like, when is this thing coming? Like, when are we going to do this or that? And me like trying to understand why.
Wow.
And so we try to put a lot of time and effort to like really continue to build that community and keep people together. And use that as like a point of prioritization, but like everything for us is like with urgency, and with, because we're just really committed to it and like really believe in what Spaces can do and what it can be.
Yeah, no, definitely. No, it sounds amazing, and it's very interesting even to hear from the inside of a core feature and product of a bigger company. You know, like you have the Twitter safety net, if you will, but at this end of the day, you're working on something that's really exciting and new for Twitter and taking it into a different direction, which is great. So it's really exciting. Okay, so before I ask you some more fun questions, I do want to talk about, for a brief period, just, I know you were really involved at Harvard in minority groups, including the National Society of Black Engineers. So I want to know, obviously it's a passion of yours. Have you been able to either use similar lessons you've learned now into, you know, the high tech scene at Twitter?
Yeah.
Yeah, and how so?
Yeah. So I'm still definitely involved in various like identity groups, both in Twitter and outside of Twitter. There are tons that happen. I think like Women in Product is like an external group and an internal group at Twitter, not necessarily connected, but both are great. Same with Blackbirds at Twitter. And I think all these communities are just really nice to just be able to see other people and support each other, and continue to learn and develop and talk about things that might be particularly challenging for being who you are in the roles that you are in.
Yeah.
So definitely still a part of them. And trying to think like lessons that I think were helpful then that are now. I don't know if there are any specific lessons that come to mind, but I think about like it's all relevant. It's all relevant. I think, you know, being a Black woman in engineering, there are not many Black women in engineering at really any school. And so like there's a lot that you learn about like being like, I may be, you know, the only person who looks like me in a room. Very much not true at Twitter. Twitter's actually one of the like higher rates of
nice.
Black women in engineering, in tech in general. But I think it's helpful to understand, like, how do you support yourself? How do you support others when you are multiple people in the room in a way that sometimes can feel isolating, about how you deal with imposter syndrome, which I think is something that frequently, like, women, people of color, those at the intersection
Definitely.
Of both experience when you feel like you're one of the only people there doing what you do. And I think those things are helpful for, like, continue on with that. Yeah.
No, that's great. It's excellent. And I can definitely relate. Imposter syndrome, all of it. I feel like it's very relevant to especially women. And then obviously, as you said, Black women, people of color. So anyway, Zarya, I would love to know, what is your favorite product? And can't be Twitter, because that's not fair.
I actually, one of my favorite products is going to be a video game. I particularly really like cooperative games that like are cooperative in the sense that you have to work together to like make it happen, but are uncooperative in the sense that everyone's angry the entire time that it's happening. I think that is a really good design to be able to walk that fine line. So games that I think of are like mostly based on the Nintendo Switch. Like if you ever played Overcooked, I personally really like
it. I do know it's like Cooking
Mama, but like in hell. And I think that's a really well-designed game because you want to play it, but it's also so incredibly frustrating. I think video games that can really balance that are good. What is it? Another one that I recently started playing, I think it's called like Lovers in a Dangerous Universe. Like that game is so stressful and all I ever want to do is play it and convince my friends to play it with me.
Wow.
So those are things that I think are really well designed and like oftentimes what I feel are unexpected answers from people, me being like cooperative games that make you want to fight your friends. Those are the games that I think are well designed.
Wow, that's a perfect description. I actually have just got introduced to Overcooked and I first like saw my friends play. And in a way, there's a lot of lessons in it too. Just like leadership, establishing a strategy and a process. And wow, and tensions get high. That is for
tensions
sure.
Tensions get high. For when sure. my friends play it, it's like nothing but us screaming.
Yes,
but it works.
Exactly. And it works. Yeah, it's so funny. Okay, well, Zarya, I absolutely loved our conversation. Thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.